Jim is a professor of crop and soil science at Texas A&M University. And Jim got his bachelor's degree at Wheaton College in Illinois, studying biology. And then he moved on to the University of Florida, where he got both his master's and PhD degrees in agronomy. He spent 10 years in Mozambique, working on a USAID grant for the Mozambique government. And then he's been at Texas A&M for the last 13 years, working on ruminant nutrition and studying condensed tannins. So Jim's going to speak to us today about a very topical subject, forage agronomy, innovate or perish.
Thank you. I'm really surprised at how many people are here this morning. After so much science and so much partying, it's amazing that you can still get up in the morning and come to this, so I appreciate your being here. I also hope expectations aren't too high. I can't look into the future. I can't completely predict the future, but certainly I think what we're doing here this morning is trying to look together, and hopefully I can go through this quickly enough to where we can have a discussion afterwards. And hopefully one of the things I'd like to do, not to accuse anybody or point any fingers, but to make us all, including myself, a little uncomfortable with where we've come from and where we're at, so that maybe our future will be a little bit more positive than it looks right now. There's no question that our discipline is disappearing. I think in the business meeting we're going to have a report on the decrease in number of presentations in C6 from over the past few years. I don't think anyone will argue with that. It's difficult, for example, and I speak mostly from the southeastern United States, and I apologize to those of you who come from overseas, but this is going to be more of an introspective talk in terms of North America, and especially the southern southeastern area. This talk was originally prepared for the Southern Pastures Group, and in fact it's available online or will be soon if you're interested. I have some hard copies here if you want to look at that later. So in the southeast, at least, if you're going to do a PhD in forage agronomy, you're not going to find any university, any department that has 3, 4, 5 forage people in that university. And that's what I had when I went to graduate school at University of Florida. That doesn't exist anymore in any universities that I'm familiar with. And I don't know about the rest of the country. When it comes to rehiring forage folks when they retire, or when they move on to another discipline, forage agronomy is always the last to be considered by our administrators. Forage specialists are getting to be a rare breed in a lot of states, certainly in the southeast. So I don't think any of us can argue that it's getting tough. It's getting tough to find the personnel. It's getting tough to find the funding for forage agronomy. And a lot of the people that would have been in this room 10 years ago are in other sections because they've seen the writing on the wall or they've found funding to be easier in other areas and they've moved on. And no criticism of them, no criticism of us, it's just a reality. Let's just look real quickly at what I'll be looking at this morning, a short history of where we've come from, why perhaps we're in the situation we are today, ideas. Some very few ideas, some of which I've gotten from you. They're not my ideas, so I don't make any claim. And then a look into the future. And again, I can't predict the future, but maybe together we can figure out a rosier picture for a future for all of us here. Those of you who are not from the States might learn a little bit from the land-grant universities were originally set up in 1862 to set up universities that were specifically targeted at the underprivileged. At that time, university education was available only if you were rich or politically connected. And this was a federal initiative that changed all that. It was very far-sighted. Hatch Act, which started the experiment stations, followed a few years later. It was set up to research for, once again, the rancher and the farmer that did not have the means to do his or her own research. and very practical problems that was written in the legislation. Extension followed a few years after that. Today, where are we? It's been a long time. It's been 150 years since the land-grant universities were started. That's a long time, folks. That's even older than I am. And a lot has changed in that time. We're no longer the people's universities. The land-grant universities consider themselves part of the elite. They don't care if you're poor or not. You have to compete to get in. You have to be good to get in. Sometimes you have to play football to get in. And ag schools are often appendages. They're no longer the most important departments. They're afterthoughts. And some universities have even done away completely with colleges of agriculture. And community colleges have replaced them as the people's education. Research, if we look at that, 125 years, a lot of research has been done in that time. A lot of good in forage agronomy. We have contributed as a group quite a bit to forage agronomy in that time. But our clients are no longer the isolated, helpless folks that they were back then. Things have changed quite a bit in society since then, and I think in great part to what forage agronomists did during that time. But perhaps as a consequence of that, the attention, the funding, and the personnel involved in research under the Hatch grants has reduced considerably. And private industry has taken its place in many ways. Extension, I have to talk very carefully about extension since I'm researching. Extension, I think, is often the most tradition-bound of the three entities, of the three stools that hold up the land-grant university system in terms of agriculture. And it's interesting to me because they're the youngest of the three pegs, but yet they're the most tradition-bound, and they fight, I think, the hardest to prove their worth, and I think that's what we all do, not just them, all of us. Technology has come a long way. In education, our landowners, our land managers are very educated. They're very knowledgeable. They can go out and often do or demand what they want without our help sometimes. So the forage agronomists we're still out there. We're still strutting our stuff, but we're a little threadbare, and our it's beginning to show a little bit of wear and tear. So why do you think we're dying as a profession? You and I look at this image, and what do we see? We see an ecosystem, right? Moisture, vegetation, animal. The public only sees the animal. You show them that picture and say, oh, look at the elephants, how cute, you know, the zebras or zebras. But I think we suffer from an image problem. I don't think that's any news to you in terms of forage agronomy, since we're focused on the plant first and the animal later. In terms of taxpayers, they're the ones that decide whether we get the funding or not, or how much funding we get. And when you go to the supermarket, you don't see a bale of hay in the supermarket. We're just not visible. And if we're not visible, they don't really care about us. It's not a criticism of us. It's just a reality. And that's something we have to live with. We also suffer from a lack of brand recognition. I mean, what is agronomy? When I applied to the agronomy department at the University of Florida, I had to look it up in the dictionary to figure out what agronomy was. And some people think maybe agronomy, you know, the general public, you know, it's an old man's ailment that you don't really talk about too much. And what is forage? People don't know what agronomy is. They don't know what forage is. Forage, is that something you do at midnight when you get hungry? You know, it's difficult to sell your discipline when you can't be taken seriously, when people don't know who or what you are. The freshmen that arrive at our universities, every fall. I've never seen one going down the hall saying, where's the agronomy department? Where can I sign up for forage agronomy? It's just not one of those disciplines that turns people on when they go to the university. There's a lot more romantic, you know, be a vet, you know, be an environmental scientist, raise horses. That's a lot more romantic than forage agronomy. So how do we save ourselves from this situation? It's definitely a situation. I don't think anyone will argue with that. The first question is, are we worth saving? I mean, have we done such a good job that we've worked our way out of a job? We no longer need to exist as a group. I mean, that's a legitimate question. Number two, if there is anything worth saving, is there anything left to save? Is it too late? Are we reacting too late in the situation to save ourselves? I think that as other people have found in the past, when they've conquered their particular discipline or their particular world, there is more to forage. I personally believe that, and I hope you agree with me. There is more to be done. We are not quite done yet. There are more worlds to conquer. That damn Macedonian had no clue what the world was like. There's a lot more out there, and I think we need to be there. Third question is, do we reinvent ourselves? Do we recreate ourselves so that we do have a future? Now, I'm going to take the example of germplasm, and this is just one example that I could present to you this morning. And again, I want you to feel uncomfortable enough to think about it, but I don't want you to feel personally attacked if I end up talking about your pet peeve or your pet germplasm or your pet plant. But one of the problems that I see, especially coming from the outside, as you heard, I came in from biology. I'm not an Aggie by undergraduate training. I worked overseas, so my perspective is definitely not North American. So I see things very differently than most people in this country. And one of the things I noticed is that we tend to work with the same species over and over and over and over. If you look at the last 2 years in the agronomy journal, crop science journal, the exact same species are being published, researched, as were 30, 40 years ago, sometimes even 100 years ago. Same species. Now, I'm not saying we should drop these species, and this is by no means a complete list, but I'm not saying we should drop these species. I'm not saying we should stop working with alfalfa. My goodness, that's not what I'm saying. But maybe instead of spending 100% of our time or 100% of our careers on you know, the same species that our major professor worked on and the same species that his or her major professor worked on, maybe we should spend 5%, 10% of our time on completely new species that contribute something to the future. And I know it's exciting when we can improve production in a system that we're working on 2 or 3%, but maybe if we go beyond the horizons that we have right now, maybe we can increase it a lot more in terms of germplasm. It's a fascinating world out there. Those of you who have started traveling a lot will know that there's so many species, so many possibilities out there. Innovation in our group, in our profession, in agriculture, sometimes I think there's a tendency to suppress innovation, unintentional tendency to suppress innovation. And again, this is a challenge to you and to me, because I'm just as guilty as anyone, if it isn't in fact true, and you can argue the opposite direction. But I'll give you an example. When I first got back here to the States from Africa, I submitted a manuscript to Agronomy Journal that was rejected. The associate editor isn't in the room, so we can speak openly about this. But the reviewers had two main criticisms. The one reviewer said he had never heard of the species that I wanted to publish on. The second reviewer said none of his producers or anywhere that he knew raised the species. So why in the world would we want it in the Agronomy Journal? Now, that to me is a compliment. If I'd been thinking at the time, I would have printed it out, framed it, and put it on the wall, because that that tells me that I'm doing my job, that I'm on the cutting edge instead of following the crowd, I'm ahead. You all have heard about the bison herd, right? The weak and the stragglers. Well, we should be in the forefront in terms of forage agronomy. Because if we keep telling people, you know, you've got to do the same thing I'm doing, you know, watch out, you have to get promotion, you have to get tenure, and if you start doing weird things, you know, your colleagues are going to slow you down, they're going to kick you out. Well, we're going to suppress the innovation that comes with the youth and new blood that comes through our group. I think in terms, again, from the outside, we have a cultural bias or a cultural tendency to force ourselves on to the natural systems, ecosystems that we find. And that's a very European tendency. I don't see that as much anywhere else in the world. And in the New World, we've certainly done that. And that tendency has been, I think, destructive and earned us a bad reputation amongst a lot of people, a lot of entities. I think today we're beginning to come out of that as a group. We're beginning to think more in terms of systems that work, not systems that we are going to force on nature, regardless of what is out there, where I'm going to do exactly as my father did or exactly as my major professor did. I think today we're mellowing a little bit. We're accepting a little bit more of a forward-looking activity. And in the future, I think we may even go completely the opposite way. Instead of imposing our expectations on whatever ecosystem we work on, maybe we're going to start working with that ecosystem, finding an animal for a forage system rather than a forage for an animal system. It's an example of that. And it's really almost back to the future in that sense. It's a situation in which Taoism is a situation where you try to, instead of fighting nature, you go with nature. Instead of forcing a system with irrigation or forcing a new germplasm onto a situation that already has its own germplasm, you go with what's there. And it's difficult because our society is not used to taking no for an answer. We are used to dominating and doing as we please. So an example of that, I'm not proposing that we all become rangeland scientists, to go completely native. That's not what I'm proposing. But I think if we use what's out there, the natural resources, the ecosystems have to provide, if we start thinking about what's out there first before we destroy it or impose our ideas, I think we'll be farther ahead. I'll give you an example. When quite often I get a call from a new landowner. I work in North Texas. And the new landowner will say, okay, you're the forage expert in this area. What forage, what pasture can I set up for my horse or my 2.5 cows or whatever land area they're working in? I want a real productive pasture. And I can almost hear in the background that the bulldozer already ticking over. Tick, 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 tick. They're there. They want to wipe out what's there. Completely plow it under and start new, because that's our mentality. That's the way we think. And I'm not saying that's not the way to go, but sometimes there might be an easier approach. I'll give you an example. If you look at nature, the species that will, the plant species that serve as bridges through bottlenecks in natural systems are those that are the deepest rooted species, right? Makes sense. So the cold systems, or cold seasons, dry seasons, drought years, what's out there and what's green right now? Brush, arboreal species, they're the ones. And yet, how many of us in this room spend 100% of our time and our careers looking solely at herbaceous species? And I'm just as guilty as you are. Perhaps we should be spending, again, 10, 20% of our time on deeper-rooted perennial systems that get us through years like we're experiencing here in Texas. Be ahead of the problem, not behind the problem all the time. That's just one example. In terms of animals, and I know we don't have control over what the market demands. And I'm not proposing that we change things, but perhaps we can choose our animal germplasm as well. And this is a difficult thing for us to accept, because when we go to graduate school, certainly when I went to graduate school, I was taught, you know, to think of forage agronomy as production. And our clients are not necessarily just interested in production. So animal germplasm, or animal that we work with, systems may be changing. And we need to change ahead of them, not behind them. And how can I put this positively? I realize that our market, and our markets throughout the world, not just in North America, demand certain products. And again, I'm not saying we drop research that incrementally increases that production, that efficiency of those species. But I think we run a risk when we do that. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But for example, what were to happen if all the cattle in the world were to disappear? And don't tell me it couldn't happen, because in some continents, like in Africa, 120 years ago, rinderpest wiped out cattle population in Africa completely, or almost completely. So it can happen, and it can happen in many ways again. If we're so married to one species and that species disappears, where does that leave our discipline? And then when the public that funded us for so many years turns around and says, why weren't you working on other animal species? And this can go for plant species as well. A pathogen, you know, a disease can come through, wipe out Bermuda grass throughout the Southeast. Where would we be? Bahia grass, whatever. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not saying we should all of a sudden, you know, work with other species. But perhaps we can work with a certain number of weird species. Do what we're supposed to do as scientists and break out of where we are. There are so many species that can depend on forages that we can work on. Some of us have caught on a little bit after the fact, but we're catching on, we're catching up, and I think we can expand our horizons. When we do that, when we expand our horizons in terms of animal and plant germplasm, we're going to expand production in those systems considerably. Let me explain how. Metabolic rates. I mean, look at what nature provides us. If we match the animal to the forage, look what happens. We have so much to work with. In terms of specialists versus generalists, if we work with an animal that depends on grass only, what happens when the grass disappears? The animal disappears. If you've traveled through the Sahel, what's left? The Sahel was not destroyed by goats. It was destroyed by cattle. And the only thing that's left are the animals that probably the agronomists there didn't work with. The flexible, that's where it's at in many situations. Bulk versus selective, again, you know, if your grass is coarse, go with a bulk grazer. If it's not, go with a concentrate feeder. And this can happen as well with the browsing aspect of what we have out there. Harvest mechanisms. We don't even think of how our animals are, the variety of animals out there, harvest the forage that we can provide. And instead of forcing the forage to match the animal, maybe we should match the animal to the forage when we can. Digestive tracts, exactly the same thing. There is so much out there that can be used. And I can guarantee you, what will take you 10 years to increase with whatever system is already there, I can probably increase 20 or 30% in those same 10 years by introducing new species, multiple species. Now, the problem, you'll say, and correctly so, is that the market isn't ready to consume cane wrap. And you're right, the market demands beef, and we should continue working with beef. I'm not saying we should stop working with that, but there are markets for cane wrap in North America, believe it or not. And whoever, if you had, you know, 1,000 breeding cane rat pairs, you'd be a rich person today. And if you're the forage agronomist working with them, you'd be ahead. Grazers versus browsers, I think we already understand that, but we use that option so rarely. Natural ecosystems show these two rhinos, completely different in their forage harvesting ability, occupy the same ecosystem with very little overlap in forage consumption, and make the system together much more productive than if you eliminate one and keep only the other. So, what can we do? My suggestion is that we try as hard as we can to keep ahead of the crowd, to keep ahead of our clients, and that's going to be difficult. One of the things we can do is stepping back and looking at the big picture. Sometimes we get so involved in looking at the NDF in our belly buttons, our crucibles, you know, that we forget to look to see what's happening out there. And I'll give you an example. If you go, where's west of San Antonio? The sun just came up there, so west is that direction. If you went west of San Antonio about 30 years ago, you'd see a lot of cattle. Today, if you see one or two herds of cattle in 200 miles in that direction, you'll be lucky. What's happened in that time? Number one, the brush has encroached because we've overgrazed with cattle. And number two, a series of droughts have hit us. You can argue whether climate is changing or not. That's irrelevant. The truth of the matter is that we tried to force an animal onto a system that really didn't belong there. And we keep doing this over and over again. And what's interesting to me is that if you go in that same direction today, you'll find lots of animals. You'll find animals that we think don't belong there and shouldn't be there and fight to destroy and get rid of. We consider them feral. And yet they're really what we should have introduced, what we should have been working with to begin with, perhaps, in that area. And I'm not saying every corner of North America or wherever you come from around the world should be that way, but I think we have a lesson to learn there. Monospecific, whether you're talking about the plant species or the animal species, is dangerous in nature, very dangerous. And yet, so often we, me included, work with monospecific pastures and monospecific herds, and we run a very large risk, not just from natural disasters, but market and historical disasters as well when we do that. Diversity, from what I see in nature, adds stability. In this ecosystem that I'm familiar with in southern Africa, these are all browsers that live within the same ecosystem, five different browsers, and there are probably more that I missed. And we can learn from nature to come up with not just a grazer and a browser, but three or four grazers and two or three browsers within the same system. And instead of increasing productivity on that land by 1% or 2% in our careers, we can increase it 100% and have it more stable as well, I think, in my opinion. Okay, so what can we do in terms of reviving agronomy? I think there's something there that's worth reviving. A few approaches, a few ideas, and again, they're not my ideas, they're our ideas. There's some things that we could perhaps talk about. Flexibility. Times have changed, we need to change with them. I think most of us are, but maybe we need to change even more. Who are our clients? When I first arrived in Texas, all I heard about was the problem of land fragmentation. Oh my goodness, it was the end of the world. Land, you know, big ranches were being split up into small ranches, and that was horrible. It was horrible for the ecosystems, horrible, you know, for agricultural research and extension. In my opinion, some of those new landowners that want that land were actually positive for the land. They were no longer farmers and ranchers, they were land managers or land owners, but they weren't producers. And because they weren't producers, they were more open to ideas, more open to sustainable methods of managing their land. And I think that's an opportunity, for example, an example of where forage agronomy can go. In many ways, our Our landowners, our land managers are no longer producers. I was chastised when I first got to this state by Extension folks for calling ranchers and farmers producers. Because in my view, they're land husbanders. They're land managers, not producers. That's not the only thing they want off the land is production. And that's something we have only begun to learn. And because we've been so slow, in Texas at least, our clients have punished us in terms of budget cuts. A lot of us have moved on to other areas, other disciplines, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. If we need fewer forage agronomists and more of whatever new comes up that needs to be addressed, not a problem. Maybe we shouldn't be so worried about it. Hopefully, some of us that stay behind stay out of choice. We're looking for new partners. Industry certainly is a good example. New disciplines that are out there within agriculture. New venues in terms of getting our information out there, getting our message out there. Joanna Newman was showing me an app that they have in Florida now for forage species selection in Florida. And that's great. That's exactly what we should be doing. But maybe we should be the ones inventing apps. And then other people following us using the idea for apping, whatever. Apping us. What I'm saying is, instead of waiting for technology, maybe we should be ahead of technology when it comes to extending what we do. Reductionism. And again, I'm getting on a little bit of a soapbox here, but I hope you'll agree with me that as agronomists, not just forage agronomists, but agronomists, we tend to reduce factors in such a way that, you know what I mean. You want to make everything else equal in your greenhouse study or your plot study, except for that one factor that goes up or down, right? Fertility or irrigation or whatever. And when we finally get finished with that, publish it in the agronomy journal, we try to put it in the real world, and it falls on its face time after time. So what are we doing wrong? I think, again, I'm not saying that we need to do away with plot studies and greenhouse studies. I do them all the time. But maybe we should design our experiments in such a way that they fit immediately into a complex world, a world that is not equal in all factors except that which we're studying. Working with teams. I think we're beginning to do that, but even stepping outside of agriculture. And this is tough for us to do because, you know, we consider ourselves hard scientists. And by outside of our College of Agriculture, working with political scientists, land tenure issues, for example, are very important. Sociologists, macroeconomists, people that we don't normally consider adding to a grant proposal or a book chapter on biomass production or whatever. I think those people can offer us a lot in terms of strengthening the relevance of our research and our outreach. Classrooms, I think, can have a broader context. And again, I'm not saying we need to do away with biochemistry or statistics, even though I hated them and you probably hated them. They're necessary evils in my, or not evils, building blocks. And maybe I'm just lazy. I don't like to look at the details, so I like to look at the broader picture, and I'll accept that criticism. But, you know, maybe we need to think about, you know, teaching political science to our majors instead of just plant science or just soil science. Because the people out there are very complex, and how they make decisions with our forages is complicated. It's not based just on what we were taught in graduate school. Research systems approach, I think, has been going on in the rest of the world far longer than in this country, but I think we're slowly catching on that we need to have a global look, not just at what the rancher wants to grow for a forage, but what they need to do with their entire ranch or their entire farm, what their goals are, what their dreams are, what their kids want to do. That all affects how our research is accepted or not accepted. Same thing with extension. Integrated systems, I think, would help considerably. Take risks. how often, and here I'm just as guilty as everybody else, how often have you designed an experiment that's going to take 2 years, but you could probably write the results and conclusions the day that you design it? I do it all the time. And I realize that we do that because there's pressure to publish, pressure to get our graduate students to publish. You know, if we don't publish, we won't get grants, we won't get promotion and tenure. But I think we need to take risks. And in fact, I think society expects us to take risks. We are paid by society to take risks. We are paid to take risks so that they, the ranchers and the farmers, do not have to take risks. Do you see what I mean? If a farmer or rancher takes a risk and falls on his face, if that bungee cord isn't quite the right length, what happens to that farm or ranch? It's gone, right? Lost after generations. But we can take that same risk. Society will still pay our salaries if we fall flat on our faces and that bungee cord is too long, 9 times out of 10. And so I think risk-taking is something that we need to take on as a group, forage agronomy especially. How many of us are researching exactly the same thing that our major professors research, and exactly the same thing as their major professors researched? Maybe we need to move on. To become relevant is to move beyond what we're comfortable with. Innovation. Push the envelope, create discomfort. The problem with innovation is that we have to go beyond what we're comfortable with, beyond what we know. And I know that's a temptation. When I'm sitting in my office at my computer and I'm writing one more manuscript for one more journal, I know how to do that. I know what I'm talking about. If the topic is within my area, I know exactly what literature to cite. I can push out that manuscript in a day and a half, and we're good to go. But if I'm talking about a book chapter or a new area that I have no knowledge about, that I have to go seek out other people to help me, or new literature, that takes me out of my comfort zone. And maybe that's what we should be doing. Looking at the big picture, sometimes that big picture, it looks negative. This is a mesquite tree, it's a little out of focus. We can't see quite what's there. You know, what's the benefit of a mesquite tree? But maybe somewhere in that system, if we take a step back, there's something positive. There's something that we can get out of that system that will make a difference. And so seeing the big picture, I think, is very important. Team teaching, research, extension, looking at systems, and natural resource management. Folks, I think you all would fit in very well in Lake Wobegon. You're all above average. For those of you from outside North America, Lake Wobegon is a mythical place somewhere in Minnesota where all the children are above average, and you all are above average. No question in my mind. And I say that seriously, because to be a forage agronomist, you really have to be above average. A maize breeder think about it. It's not difficult to conclude that we are above average. We're also not afraid. I think that we are up to the challenge, and it's an exciting new world out there. It is a challenge, but I think we can overcome it. Now, I'm going to make one prediction here today, and hopefully we have a little bit of time to discuss this, but I will bet you a Coke, Stuart, a beer in our case, that within our generation, forage agronomists or ruminant production in North America and much of the world will be forced off the best land, will be told not to use any irrigation water whatsoever, will be told not to use any fossil fuel inputs whatsoever, will be told not to use any herbicides or other pesticides whatsoever. And this all will be done not through legislation or not through the fringe, you know, environmentalists that are pushing us off the best land, but by market forces. Population in this world is getting bigger and bigger, and the demand for crop food is going to be stronger and stronger. Forage agronomy is going to be pushed off the grid if we're not careful. We need to be off that grid, well ahead of the crowd, if we want to be relevant in the future. That's just my opinion. My suggestion is we take some time to discuss opinions. I don't know if we have time before our business meeting.